America's Supreme Court has had a very busy week. What can we make of all of their rulings? Major German companies are planning record layoffs, while German police say the Germany that we know is disappearing. Where is this crisis leading Germany? We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome to Trumpet World and a happy Independence Day to all of our viewers from the United States, and I guess a belated happy Canada Day to all of our Canadian viewers as well. Because our office is closed on July 3rd, the Friday this year, we're going to do things a little differently. We're each recording our segments ahead of time on our own, and we'll play them back to you. And in honor of Independence Day, we'll put America first and go straight to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Here in the United States this week, the U.S. Supreme Court is preparing to go into its summer recess, which means it's handing out many decisions on big and often controversial cases that it's been reviewing and hearing oral arguments for the past several months. These cases are ranging from cases regarding how much authority the U.S. president has, to how to secure the U.S. border, to whether Roundup is something that can legally be produced. But there's two cases in particular I actually want to zoom in on today and talk and about in a little more detail, because they do have some far-reaching effects from the nation. The first one is actually a case they decided 2 days ago regarding the much-debated birthright citizenship. This is something to where in the United States for years there's been a problem where you either have illegal immigrants from Latin America just crossing the Rio Grande River in secret, having a baby in the country. That baby is a citizen because it was born here, and then you can't deport the parents without separating families. And it's caused a lot of legal turmoil. You also have like the Chinese birth tourism industry, where you've got like Chinese billionaires who want more influence in the United States. So they actually like pay a surrogate to have their child in the United States. And so this is something that the Trump administration issued some executive orders really cracking down on this birth tourism industry and saying that, like, well, just because you're born here, if your parents were illegal, you're not here legally. Obviously, the Trump administration was sued from it, and this has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, been debated for a number of months. Finally, this week, we got a ruling saying that basically overturning the Trump executive order and saying that birthright citizenship is a constitutional right. Very controversial ruling is it's largely based off the text of the 14th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment, the text of the 14th Amendment says that those born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens. And so for the past several decades, there's been a lot of attention on that clause born in the United States and not very much attention on to the subject or the jurisdiction thereof. That's why the court's most conservative justices, Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, they ruled in dissent against this ruling, saying that, like, yes, the 14th Amendment says those born in the United States and under the jurisdiction of the United States are citizens. But if someone came here illegally, they're not in the country legally, which means by definition they're not following the country's laws and are therefore not under the jurisdiction of the country. And the birthright citizenship shouldn't apply to them. It should only apply to legal immigrants. Actually, the key architect of the 14th Amendment, a senator who was active back in the 1860s, said as much, saying that this amendment will not apply to illegal immigrants, sons of diplomats, and the like. So from a constitutional textualist standpoint, the text of the Constitution says that those not under the jurisdiction of the United States do not receive citizenship. And from a constitutionally originalist standpoint, the people who wrote the 14th Amendment said that it didn't apply to illegal immigrants. And so this is definitely a case of judicial activism perpetrated by the liberal justices on the court and then two or three nominal conservatives who switched over to their side and has quite a few people concerned about the implications that it's now going to make the United States a target for basically as many people who can get here illegally as possible. If they then have a child, they've got an anchor that they can potentially stay. However, like I said, this isn't the only court case this week, and it does, I feel like the fact that the Supreme Court ruled against Trump here does highlight some of the nuance in a Bible prophecy we have about the Supreme Court. Our editor-in-chief wrote an article several years back called "Is the Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy?" And he focuses in on prophecies in Amos 7 about an end-time Jeroboam figure who's supported by a religious organization called the King's Chapel and another legal organization called the King's Court. That's the phrase used in the King James Bible. If you actually look at the original Hebrew, though, King's Chapel is a good translation. King's Court isn't quite accurate. It should more be Kingdom's Court. And so in that article, Mr. Flory highlights that the Supreme Court is this Kingdom's Court referenced in Amos 7. And it definitely supports or favors the Jeroboam figure, Donald Trump. However, unlike the King's Chapel, which is personally loyal to Donald Trump, this is like the evangelical advisors led by Paula White and others that are very, very personally loyal to Donald Trump. The Supreme Court isn't personally loyal to him. They're not the King's Court. They're the Kingdom's Court. But they do often favor him and support his fight against like the deep state in America. So this new court case about the Supreme Court, they didn't uphold the Constitution, nor did they uphold the Trump administration's decision in this birthright citizenship case, does highlight that they're not personally loyal to Jeroboam. They're very willing to make decisions that he's not okay with. But overall, they're still supporting him. And that's why I actually think this second court decision they made is probably the more significant of the two. This is Trump versus Slaughter, where Trump, he had fired someone in the Federal Trade Commission and then was sued for doing that on a 90-year-old precedent saying that the president can't fire members of the Federal Trade Commission unilaterally. The Supreme Court struck that down and said that he could. So the immediate effect is you fired one person, and that may not seem like a huge case. But the far-reaching effect of this case is by overturning a 90-year-old precedent, it's basically moving the nation back towards a time when the president can fire anyone in the executive branch. A lot of the liberals on the court are very concerned about that. They say it's going to turn Donald Trump into a king and give him too much power. But the constitutional rationale for it is actually very straightforward. As most people learn in like middle school civics, the U.S. Constitution is broken into three branches, a legislative branch that makes the laws, an executive branch that enforces the laws, and a judicial branch that takes care of the court cases. The executive branch is run by the president, and in fact, is the only the president and the vice president are the only members of the executive branch who are led by the who are elected by the people, and the only members of the executive branch who are specifically mentioned in the Constitution. So what happens when you say that the executive can't fire people in the executive branch is now the chief executive no longer runs the executive branch if he can't fire people. And so you get an unconstitutional fourth branch of government run by bureaucrats who, once they gain office, they're not elected by anybody, they wield tremendous power, and they can't be fired by the people elected by the president, the president elected by the people. So this fourth branch of government, these unaccountable, unelected bureaucrats, that is the definition of the deep state. When you hear, definitely if you hear me talk about the deep state, that's what I'm talking about, is these bureaucrats that basically run the country and are accountable to no one. So by ruling that the president can actually fire these people, it brings this fourth branch of government back under the authority of the executive branch, which is in the Constitution. So massively significant court case that does a long way at restoring America back towards its original constitutional model by weakening the administrative state or the deep state. By actually strengthening the president, not to unconstitutionally usurp power from the courts or usurp power over Congress, but just to fulfill his constitutional role as the head of the executive branch. And I feel like the court made this decision here is, to me, it's definitely proof of what Mr. Gerald Ford wrote in America Under Attack about Donald Trump being an end-time Jeroboam figure supported by the King's Chapel and supported by the King's Court. Because the U.S. presidents kind of lost control over the civil service all the way back in the time of Franklin Roosevelt. And so for like 80 years, no president has actually really had the authority to rule his own branch of government. And the fact that that's changing now, just a few years after Mr. Fleury predicted that it would change and that you would have a president supported by the Supreme Court actually exercising some authority over the executive branch of government, is something that we've been predicting for a long time. Mr. Fleury first wrote about like the King's Court back, I think, around 2018. And then we've published some articles since then about Donald Trump's war against the deep state. And so this court case is actually really showing the Supreme Court empowering Donald Trump to defeat the deep state. And so definitely showing the Supreme Court favoring Donald Trump, but not necessarily being like just sycophantically loyal to him, because they have made other rulings on birthright citizenship that he does not approve of. But I feel like just looking at these two court cases, the birthright citizenship and then his control over the executive agencies, does highlight the fact that the Supreme Court is empowering the Donald Trump administration to take on these deep state agencies that have hijacked the country, without ruling that he's right all the time. So yeah, some big court cases, and I'm sure we'll have some other big ones coming up next season. A few other news stories in the Anglo-American region, also having major wildfire problems in the western United States. As of yesterday, I believe there were 79 wildfires burning across 10 states. At least 3 firefighters killed, many people evacuated. This is an interesting story in that the ecosystem of the western United States is a place where some wildfires are natural. This has occurred every year in recorded history. But the reason the wildfires are so bad this year, and they're actually about twice as bad as the 10-year average, is because the Western United States has been in a 26-year-long drought, and a pretty bad one. Dendrologists can look at the tree rings to actually estimate, like, trees grow faster when there's rain and they grow slower when there's not rain, that this is actually the worst drought in 1,200 years. The last time the drought was this bad was like 800 AD when Charlemagne was being crowned and the Mayan Empire was still the dominant power in North America. So a long time ago, definitely highlighting many of the Bible prophecies in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 and Joel 1 and in the book of Amos about drought in particular being a curse God sends on end time Israel to punishment for its sins. A lot of people are blaming this on, like, you know, global warming and greenhouse gas emissions, and I don't, that definitely doesn't make sense to me, because it's like the drought was just as bad in 800 AD when there were no greenhouse gas emissions and no one drove cars. So it's not the worst in human history. It's the worst it's been in a long time. And the Mayans were involved in human sacrifice and sexual immorality and a lot of the other sins that America is being punished for today. So I actually feel like if you try to correlate those tree rings and the drought in the Western United States compared to greenhouse gas emissions on the one hand and, like, just national morality on the other, I actually see a much closer correlation with the types of sins America's gotten into today, showing just a huge curse on the nation. And then two other quick stories is one showing just how radically left the Democratic Party has shifted. Here this week, we're at the 250-year anniversary of the United States, and many people are turning against America's founding virtues, with the latest opinion poll showing that 1 in 3 Democrats now supports democratic socialism. Now, this isn't social democracy where the government just regulates the economy. This is actual, legit democratic socialism where the government seizes the means of production and actually owns the big industries. And these polls show that 1 in 3 Democrats, probably only 2 in 10 Americans overall, indicating that the Democratic Party shift towards overt Marxism is probably going to hurt them in this year's midterm elections. The majority of Americans don't agree with them. But a rising share of Democrats do. And so even though it hurts them in the midterm elections, it definitely highlights a threat to the nation, is that a lot of these democratic socialists are actually self-avowedly admitting that they want communism and that they're actually even willing to fight to get it. Just showing the Democratic Party's shift from a left-wing political party to an actual violent communist one that has severe national security implications. And then we'll end with one economic story. The Bank of International Settlements in Europe actually ruled that there's one of the four greatest threats to the global economy right now is the AI bubble. This is many people around the world, but especially in America, realizing that artificial intelligence is a world-changing technology and investing tremendous amounts of money into it without a very clear plan about how this is going to turn a profit. And basically it's created a $2.5 trillion bubble. The Bank of International Settlements had even compared it to the dot-com bubble that popped in the year 2000. where the internet was a new technology. People knew it was going to change the world. Investors started throwing money at it. It grew into a $3 trillion bubble, which popped, and half the new internet companies went out of business. Investors lost about 75% of their money. Now, out of that pop, you had surviving companies like Amazon and Google that actually did come out and do well long term. And it seems like this AI revolution might be the same. It's a world-changing technology. There are going to be companies that do well, but we don't know which of those companies are yet. A lot of these new AI startups are undoubtedly going to go out of business at some point, which means you're going to have a massive shock to the financial system at some point in the next few years, as we have survivors and winners and losers in this market. And the risk is that America's national debt is 7 times bigger now than it was during the dot-com bubble. And so the nation is not nearly as well prepared to weather something like that as it was 26 years ago.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Everyday life in Germany has become a pressure cooker. That's what Dr. Sven R. Larsen wrote in the European Conservative last week. The question, he continued, is when that pressure cooker is going to blow up and what forms that explosion will take. That's a pretty powerful warning and one worth taking seriously. He warned that a perfect storm of economic decline, of things like the migrant crisis, and then a government that suppresses free speech and refuses to allow people to talk about these issues is leading to a dramatic explosion. And certainly this week we've seen Germany hit with wave after wave of economic bad news. His article came shortly before news leaked out that Volkswagen is planning to close 4 of its German factories and eliminate 100,000 jobs. That's about 15% of its global workforce. Reuters called it the largest restructuring in automotive industry history. Now, this is what they're reportedly discussing internally, news of that leaking out. It's not an official announcement, so I guess it could change. But this is a big deal for a company that has never closed a factory within Germany. Perhaps even worse, the leaks reveal the results of an internal poll of 9 members of VW's management and supervisory boards. 6 of them said they do not believe the company has a future. That's it. That's the end of Volkswagen, I guess, is what they believe, eventually. Its shares are down 25% so far just this year. And it's just the latest in a whole range of bad news over the past few months for Germany's manufacturing industry. Germany lost over 125,000 industrial jobs in the last 12 months, according to a study by the consultancy EY, published in May. That's a fall of 2.3%. The EI report also highlighted a 10% drop in foreign businesses launching projects within Germany. The head of EY in Germany, Heinrich Eilers, he said that in Germany, the high tax burden, high labor costs, expensive energy, and at the same time, a paralyzing bureaucracy are slowing down investment events. He said that Germany is gaining a global reputation for an inability to reform. Unfortunately, not much remains of the image as a strong quality location, an economic rock in the storm, he warned. Germany's Steel Foundation has also warned this year that the sector is at a turning point due to high energy costs and declining demands. And in April, the government was forced to halve its economic growth forecast for the year to just 0.5%. That's compared to 2% in the United States. So however bad the economy and growth is in America, it's 4 times worse in Germany. And this isn't just making Germany poorer. This is wrapped right up with Germany's self-image. Many Germans don't want to take pride in their pre-1945 history, so instead they take pride in their economic miracle, Germany's comeback as a major manufacturing powerhouse after World War II. And then another crisis for Germany is immigration. 10 years after Angela Merkel threw the doors open for Syrian migrants, this migrant crisis and migrant figures are still a powerful force in German politics. The numbers have come down since then, but a lot of the people that have moved to Germany haven't left. So when you're talking about migrants arriving each year, you're adding to a pre-existingly high population. About 16% of those in Germany don't have German citizenship. yet they account for 34% of all the suspects of crime. Around 900,000 Syrians live in Germany, and 115,000 of them were identified as suspects by police in 2024. That's a staggering rate. One in nine? More than one in nine. And in fact, Syrians in Germany commit crimes at a rate 16 times higher than the average German. For those from Afghanistan, it's 14 times higher. In some states, half of all violent crime suspects are non-Germans. And okay, this is suspect rather than convictions. There could be more to learn here, potentially, as more detailed statistics come out. But I think it's very clear that migrants are dramatically overrated in Germany's crime rates. And the statistics about rape and sexual assaults, again, they're not conclusive, but they give us some pretty dangerous hints. The incidents of rape are rising alarmingly. In 2018, there were about 8,000 reported cases. In 2025, it was 14,000. And again, migrants are significantly overrepresented in sexual crimes. And the impact of all of this on a high-trust society is huge. If you look at somewhere like France, for example, that's had problems with people dodging fares on public transport for decades. Germany's rail system, you know, was built kind of around the assumption that everyone would be honest. There aren't, or at least there weren't, the kind of barriers and turnstiles that you see in the London Underground or in the New York Metro or in Paris, because it was generally built around the assumption that most people would be honest and buy a ticket, even if they weren't checked. There's no checkpoints or turnstiles, or at least there weren't traditionally, just occasional inspections. And that's just one pretty small example, but that's the whole, the way German society functioned. The influx of a large number of migrants that play by different rules means that the trusting society that many grew up with is gone. The influx of migrants is also just quickly transforming German demographics. In 2005, 13 million German residents had a migrant background. Today, it's 22 million. And that's both due to people moving to the country and to migrants living in Germany having more children. And now one third of those aged 25 to 34 have a migrant background compared to just 14% of seniors. So migrants and the children of migrants are going to have a much bigger impact on German society going forwards. But with the crime particularly, many are outraged. German filmmaker Uwe Boll, he recently produced a film called Citizen Vigilante. Not one that I'm recommending. It's a pretty graphic, violent one by all accounts, but it shows migrants brutally killing Europeans, and those scenes are based on real-life news stories. And then it shows many of those migrants being killed by a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, former American soldier who's taken upon himself to dish out justice. He also dishes out justice on judges that are very lenient on criminals, and others that are complicit in this. And Boll said he made the film directly because of migrant attacks in Europe. He said, if you look at what happened in Hamburg, where the rapists walked free without any penalty, the coverage in the media was like, oh, the poor perpetrators. It's as if we're living in a completely insane and absurd political environment, especially in Europe, where people have completely lost track. There's a huge difference between so-called hate speech and stabbing people in the neck, but facts don't matter anymore. And he said he's not encouraging people to take matters into their own hands. Instead, he kind of put his thoughts in the words of the protagonist speaking to Interpol, saying, if the politicians who pay you do not fight against Islamism and the woke left, the population will soon do as I do and carry out a great cleanup themselves. Boll, too, is warning of an explosion. Now, Germany's Film Classification Board refused to give the movie any rating, effectively banning it from being released in the country. And it's not just filmmakers that are upset. German police are too, at least according to investigative journalist Liv von Bottischer. She told Deutsche Welle last week that once the cameras weren't rolling and they were off the record, police pretty much unanimously said it's getting worse and worse. One police officer told her, the Germany we know is disappearing. Another said, in Germany, it is open season for robbery and rape. Another, even the most serious crimes often have surprisingly few consequences. Far too often, perpetrators more or less get away with it. Or another quote, some police officers even told me, quite literally, we've already lost this country, or this country is finished. And then you have the inability of German elite to stomach any debate or major criticism of their handling of the country. And that's another critical part of this pressure cooker. Germans are banned from insulting their political leaders on social media by Section 188 of the German Criminal Code, passed in 2021. Last year, almost 5,000 criminal cases were launched under this law. And remember, even if somebody's found innocent in one of these type of cases, you know, they've been through a punishing ordeal. And that's by design. Police raided a man's house after he called the former Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck a moron. One man was fined over 2,000 euros for calling the Chancellor Friedrich Merz a liar. Another had to pay about 100 euros for calling a politician a pompous fool. And another was prosecuted for posting a meme showing Merz as Pinocchio. In his case, the case was eventually dropped after public outcry. And it's this kind of lack of any outlet that prompted the warning that we began this with. Everyday life in Germany has become a pressure cooker. The question is when that pressure cooker is going to blow up and what forms the explosion will take. Larsen continued to say, if anything, increasingly hardline political persecution will continue to lead Germany into the dark realm of tyranny. What we can expect, he wrote, in other words, is for the German government to ignore the formation of a perfect storm of societal decline. Instead of recognizing the real threats to Germany's future, the government in Berlin will continue to fight the symptoms of that decline, growing support for the Alternative for Deutschland, declining morale in police, and perennial budget deficits. The German elite's method of suppression will become harsher and more unforgiving. A government that transitions from democracy and freedom to totalitarianism and suppression of dissent will sooner or later, with eerie predictability, try to dictate the nation's economy in the same way it dictates politics and public opinion. At that point, Germany's political decline will escalate to an economic implosion. And yeah, this is a powerful and accurate warning. The only group that will discuss all of these problems is the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD that he mentioned there. They want to limit migration, they want to shake up the German economy. They tried to repeal those censorship laws that I mentioned. No wonder they're close to having an absolute majority in at least one German state. While every other German party flounders, the AfD are going from strength to strength. But this is also a party with major baggage. Its top leaders deliberately use Nazi slogans. They give speeches about the need to be proud of, quote, the accomplishments of German soldiers in World War II. They want to end commemoration of the Holocaust. But in pressure cooker Germany, many voters don't mind handing power over to a Nazi-sympathetic party if it helps solve these problems. And those that know Germany well, beyond just Dr. Larsen, have sounded these kind of warnings for decades. And here's what Nicholas Frank, son of the Nazi war criminal Hans Frank, told the BBC in 2017.
As long as our economy is great, and as long as we made money, everything is very democratic. But let's wait and hopefully not see if we have 5 to 10 years heavy economical problems, and the swamp is a lake, and is a sea, and will swallow again everything.
After that, we had him over to come talk to us, and here's what he said when Brad McDonald interviewed him.
Acknowledge that the German people didn't initiate any war the last 70 years. That's a good thing. But the next 70 years will follow, so be careful. Never trust the German. What Mr. Churchill was saying is a brilliant sentence. You have the Germans either to your knees or at your throat. And that's exactly, that's a very good characteristic of the German people.
Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry and his predecessor Herbert W. Armstrong have warned about this change in Germany for even longer. In his first major Trumpet article on the subject of Germany in 1991, Mr. Flurry wrote, if a real crisis develops, will the Germans call for a new Führer, you know, a new strongman? Your Bible says that's going to happen. That crisis will probably be triggered by an economic collapse in the U.S. I think it's interesting, you look at the role that Larsen mentioned in an economic collapse. The government tries to dictate to the economy, everything blows up. What happens next? Public have already been used to tyranny and suppression of free speech. Who will they welcome in? to try and get them out of that mess. We are close to that crisis now. The strongman is almost here. Talking about the rise of the AfD last summer, Mr. Flory wrote that the rise of this extreme party is just one sign of a German society in trouble. It's this strong, charismatic leader that Germany and many other people across Europe are desperate for, he wrote in that same article. They see their country spinning out of control. And this isn't just a German phenomenon. People don't trust European bureaucrats, he wrote. They want a strong leader to rescue them. They're calling for a new Charlemagne to lead the European Union. All the way back in 1950, Herbert Armstrong described European nations becoming, quote, distrustful of America and thinking more and more about uniting themselves into a United States of Europe. And to do that, he said, they need a new supreme leader, the successor of Adolf Hitler, to rise up and assert himself and take command. And how closely these long-standing forecasts match what we're seeing in Germany today and across Europe. You know, these men basically talked about an explosion, a government that transitions from democracy and freedom to totalitarianism for decades. And they sounded this warning because of what the Bible said. Here's how Mr. Armstrong began one of his World Tomorrow broadcasts.
Well, greetings, friends. This is Herbert W. Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Gradually, and now faster and faster, a new power is being developed from underneath the surface, a new world power, which the public now least suspects, which the world does not yet see, doesn't realize, doesn't dream is coming, but it is developing just as prophesied in Europe. A resurrected Roman Empire that will combine some 350 millions of population, a power so mighty that our Western peoples will stand aghast when it flashes suddenly into full being. Yes, your Bible says that the world will be startled, that it will wonder, all whose names are not written in God's book of life. And then at that time, there is to be an invasion by this power that is rising up in Europe. That is the next thing to happen now. And the stage is being set. Everything is happening that way. The people don't realize it. They don't know what is going on this earth. I tell you, my friends, it's time we do blow the dust off our Bibles and realize that about one-third of your Bible is prophecy, that it has to do with this pulsating, moving, chaotic, upset world present, and that it tells what it's all about and where we're headed and why. Where are we going from here? What's going to happen?
Mr. Flory is also, again, on his Key of David program, warned about the rise of a strong leader and how he's going to come along and transform all of Europe. Here's what he said in a Key of David program 8 years ago.
Again, Germany's not going to start wars until they have this strong man to lead them into that war. And there is a vacuum in Germany today. They have great power. They dominate and even domineer Europe. But they lack a strong leader. And they're not about to go to war until they have that strong leader. They wouldn't even go into Syria with America and France and Britain. They need the strong man to do that. But once they have the strong man, then he stirs them up and they follow along very willingly in most cases. They like their strong leader, and especially in times of crisis, especially at that time.
Now, why did they give these warnings? Well, Revelation 17 describes a beast, an empire in biblical symbolism, led by a woman or a church. It rises and falls repeatedly. This could only be describing the Holy Roman Empire, which has repeatedly dominated Europe. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space, states Revelation 17 and verse 10. There's one more strong king, strong leader coming. When God revealed this prophecy to Mr. Armstrong, five of these kings were in the past. Hitler was on the scene. There was one more of these kings to come. Verse 12 talks about 10 kings. More junior kings under this strongman, showing this final strongman rules a union of 10 nations. That's why that even as far back as 1945, Mr. Armstrong said that Germany would rise again as part of a sort of European Union. He used those exact words, and we see a European Union today. The EU, the European Union, it currently has 27 nations. It will take some kind of crisis to shake them down to 10. That could happen in the same explosion which brings this strongman to power. Germany and really all of Europe is ready to explode. That strong man is going to be here very soon. God says he's raising him up to correct the sinning people of Britain and America. So now is the time to understand what is happening, why is happening. We have a free book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that will do just that. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can download it. You can order a free print copy. You can study it alongside your Bible so that you can prove this for yourself out of the Bible. It will take you through Revelation 17. It will take you through more scriptures like Daniel 8 that discuss this strong man and what he means for the world, what he means for you. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. All right, a couple more European stories I just wanted to run down for you. One is that an ultra-conservative Catholic group ordained four bishops this week in direct defiance of instructions from Pope Leo XIV. This is the Society of St. Pius X. They're founded as a priestly group within the Catholic Church in the 1970s. They disagree with the modernizing reforms made at the Second Vatican Council. They think Mass should be celebrated in Latin, not in the vernacular. They oppose outreaches to other Christian denominations and other religions. They disagree with steps towards endorsing the idea of religious freedom that were taken in Vatican II. They instead believe that government should force Catholicism on their people. And also major leaders in that group have denied the Holocaust. They've endorsed anti-Semitic propaganda, such as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. They've spread blood libels, accusing the Jews of using Christian blood in their rituals. Now, this society, the SSPX, they were excommunicated in 1988 when they consecrated new bishops without the Pope's approval. In 2009, Pope Benedict lifted the excommunication to try and close the rift. That lifting actually sparked a pretty major row with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who didn't like the group because of their anti-Semitism, or at least that of some the anti-Semitism of some of its leaders. But now the society has ordained four more bishops. And once again, just like in 1988, it comes after the Pope specifically said not to, and they seem to be heading towards excommunication once again. And this group, they were faced with the same dilemma as they were in 1988. If they have no living bishops, the society dies out. The current bishops are old. So either they ordain more bishops and get excommunicated, or they gradually go extinct. So you know, they chose the excommunication route. About 600,000 people attend Mass with the SSPX. So when you think about a world of over a billion Catholics, you know, not all of them attend Mass regularly, but still, as a percentage, fairly small, but 600,000 is a whole lot of people. And they are a pretty vibrant part of the Catholic Church, a growing part of the Catholic Church. There's a lot of interest on things like the traditional Latin Mass. In a world where compromise and modernization are the norm, this arch-conservative group has a lot of appeal. It looks more ancient, it looks more authentic, it looks more anchored in tradition, instead of being blown about by modern secular doctrines. But it also means some dangerous views and a headache for the Vatican, which is trying to itself kind of give the same appeal to a bigger audience of being a religion that is ancient and authentic. But what is it that really makes God's true church? You know, I think people are right to say, well, yeah, if the Bible is the word of God, well, God's church isn't going to be a church that's compromising with the world, that's updating its doctrines to conform with what society believes. You can understand why people would look at groups like the Catholic Church or even the SSPX as they try to find, well, which church is God's? But the Bible tells us how to find God's church. It shows us what to look for. And we have a free booklet on exactly that. It is called Can You Prove Which Church is God's? And it will help you look at, well, is it the Catholic Church? Is it the Society of St. Pius X? Is it something else entirely? And it will show you from the Bible what things, attributes that God's church is going to have. Then a final story, Germany's preparing to give the defense startup Helsinger a $500 million contract to develop software for drones and aircraft and other sensors to operate together. Germany was originally planning to develop this software as part of its sixth generation fighter jet program that it was operating with France and Spain. The jet program was canceled, but it seemed like these three countries would still work on developing a cloud combat system, is what they called it, together. But internal documents now show that Germany is pursuing its cloud combat system independently, according to Politico. They're preparing this $580 million contract for Helsing to develop the combat fighter system Nucleus. And seems likely they may well have learned lessons from work they've done in Ukraine and elsewhere that they don't want to share with France or with Spain. Helsing has been very involved with what goes on in 2022. It's also unusual to trust a startup with such a significant project. I mean, if successful, this kind of cloud system is going to be the backbone of Germany's air force or a lot of its aerial warfare. The document seen by Politico also showed the defense ministry looking at ways to avoid scrutiny from parliament. They were also looking at getting an exemption from normal EU procurement rules. So it looks like Germany's up to something big here that they don't even want to share with their European partners. So that's an interesting story to keep watching. And we have our article, Germany is Arming for World War III, that has more on this topic. Well, that is it for Europe. We'll go now to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
The big story for the Asia region is that the pressure on Russia is continuing to increase, and more analysts believe it'll soon lead to some sort of potentially dramatic escalation on Russia's part. So the pressure is due to several factors. First of all, Russia is not making gains on the battlefields in Ukraine. This war has gone on now for longer than the Soviet Union's fight against Nazi Germany, and it's gone on for longer than all of World War I. But for the last couple of years, Russia's battlefield gains have been negligible. And the most recent data even suggests that Russia has actually been losing territory over the last couple of months. And of course, this has come at an appalling human cost for the Russians. Their casualties now are close to 1.5 million, and 500,000 of those are believed to be dead. And it keeps getting harder and harder for Russian invaders because of Ukraine's drones. The math now looks like as many as 8 Russians die or are wounded for every Ukrainian casualty. So just a remarkable ratio there. So the war effort for Russia, it is faltering at best. And at the same time, Ukraine is increasingly pushing the war inside of Russia, mostly with relentless drone strikes on Russian refineries and fuel storage sites and pipelines and energy export infrastructure. Energy, of course, is the lifeblood of the Russian economy. So this Ukrainian campaign is just draining the Kremlin's finances. And it's also humiliating and painful to the Russian people. There have been gasoline shortages across the nation, with people waiting in line for hours and hours to fuel up their cars or not being able to fuel up at all in many cases. So the mood of the Russian people is really souring. And not just the ordinary people, but even the elites who previously supported Putin because he's really the one who enriched them so much. The Financial Times recently quoted a Russian businessman as saying, quote, "Everyone is furious. People in the Russian elite are in full agreement. This is a catastrophe." End quote. And then we had a similar quote from a Russian businessman who spoke with The Guardian recently. He said, "There's a growing realization that utterly senseless, self-destructive decisions keep being made. People who once defended Putin no longer do. Any sense of a future has disappeared." End quote. So you can hear the pressure building and building inside of Russia, and pressure on Putin himself continuing to increase there. And because of this, more and more analysts are saying that the status quo is not sustainable and that Putin could soon escalate. Foreign Policy wrote about this a few days back, saying, "As things get worse for Russia on the battlefield, in the economy, and for Putin personally, there is the risk that the flailing Russian leader will succumb to drowning man syndrome. When a swimmer in difficulty pushes others underwater in a desperate attempt to stay afloat, his temptation will be to escalate both at home and abroad. Beware the drowning man. The coming months will likely be dangerous outside and inside Russia as Putin tries desperately to stay afloat." End quote. And then George Friedman of Geopolitical Futures also spoke about this week, a fascinating interview. And Friedman said that in his view, Vladimir Putin still has at least three good ways to escalate. One of them is mobilizing Russia's reserve forces. This is hundreds of thousands of men who have not yet been in the fight and who have training, and they could be mobilized very quickly. The second option is to force Belarus to join Russia's war and to send their men there to fight. The leader of Belarus would not like that, but this man is completely beholden to Vladimir Putin, so he really wouldn't have a choice. And then the third possibility, in George Friedman's view, is the most chilling at all. That is for Putin to use nuclear weapons. Russia, of course, has the world's largest arsenal of nuclear weapons, and so far has not used those in this war. Putin knows, of course, that the decision to use them would come with serious complications. It could possibly bring Europe and or the United States into direct confrontation with Russia. Putin also knows that China has warned him that using nuclear weapons is not an option. So it would bring big complications, but for a drowning man lashing out at anything he can to try to draw another breath, this option is not off the table. Geopolitical analyst Peter Zion also spoke about the increasing pressure on Russia in a briefing this week. And like George Friedman, Zion also mentioned the possibility of Putin using nuclear weapons. So the pressure is building and Putin's options are narrowing. So there's a lot to keep an eye on there, but we can be sure that Putin is not defeated. This war may not be going the way that he wants it to, but we know that he won't be ousted, and that's because of what Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has said about Putin's role in Bible prophecy. Mr. Flurry has identified Vladimir Putin as an end-time figure called the Prince of Rosh, or the Prince of Russia, in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. And these passages show that this Prince of Russia will soon be fighting far larger wars than this current one, and he'll be at the head of this massive pan-Asian alliance. So even though right now the pressure on Russia is building and the pressure on Putin is building, we shouldn't expect him, Vladimir Putin, to be taken out by this. And Mr. Flurry has a booklet all about these passages in Ezekiel and about, you know, many related Bible passages as well. And it puts Putin's leadership in context that you won't find anywhere else. So for anyone who would like to understand that, I hope you'll order your free copy of his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And then I've also got a couple of smaller stories about the Asian region here. First up, we have some evidence that Putin is very much looking ahead to those larger wars I mentioned that he'll soon be fighting. This evidence comes in the form of a new law that was passed that requires Russian schools to more than double the amount of instruction time devoted to teaching children basic military training. This goes into effect at the start of Russia's next academic year in September, and it concerns a course called Fundamentals of Security and Defense in the Motherland. This is a course for grades 6 through 11 in Russian schools, and it previously allocated about 20% of its curriculum to direct military training for these students, but the new law increases that from 20% up to 50%. So these students will be getting many hours every year of instruction in things like drone warfare, field training. They'll even have hand-to-hand practice with mock weapons such as AK-47s and hand grenades. So it's clear here that Putin is getting the next generation ready to fight. And then one final story here about China covertly training Russian troops so that they can fight as effectively as possible. Russia watchers have long known that Russia has been getting considerable training from Chinese military leaders. But this week we learned that that was personally ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin, and we learned that it's happening at the highest possible levels of the Russian military, with Chinese generals meeting with Russian generals. And it's all at Putin's order. So this is happening, as I said, at the highest echelons. Russia and China are training together and actually making war together.
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. The news in the Middle East is little changed from last week. Peace deals with Lebanon and American pressure on Israel continue to dominate the news headlines here. So with Mihailo Zekic taking a little bit of a break over this these few days, we thought we'd give him a week off and allow us to concentrate on some of those bigger or at least more changed stories from other parts of the world. So that is it for this week's Trumpet World. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to our correspondents and to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. And again, a happy July 4th to our American listeners. I'll point you to our latest Trumpet print magazine, How America Became Great, that really is your essential companion for this 250th anniversary. Also, if you go to thetrumpet.com right now, there's a banner at the top, 7 things you didn't know about American greatness. They've put together a pretty neat webpage that summarizes some of the statistics and animates some of the material from that Trumpet print edition. So you can go to our website, thetrumpet.com, and check that out. We'll be back next week with our regular set of programs. You can email the show at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd love to hear from you. So we'll be back next week. Until then, keep watching your world.